RTL Original Podcast.
He was a monster. In my eyes, he was a monster. Those haunting words belong to Rosanna Campanella, one of the few survivors of Luxembourg's most notorious predator. She was just 24 years old when her life intersected with the man who would later be known as the country's first serial killer. Between 1983 and 1989, Luis Matias terrorized the streets of Luxembourg. 7 women were attacked. 4 survived, 3 did not. And yet, for 6 long years, Louis evaded justice. In today's episode of DNA Luxembourg Crime Podcast, we unpick the failures, the fear, and the forgotten voices of victims in one of Luxembourg's darkest chapters. This is the story of Luxembourg's first serial killer. Luxembourg is not the place where you'd expect to find a serial killer. Yet history tells a different story. A man by the name of Louis Matias, considered the country's first, forced the nation to confront a crime that few thought would be possible here. The term serial killer was popularized in the 1970s by the FBI, but the behavior long predates the label. From Jack the Ripper stalking Victorian London in the 1880s to the infamous Bloody Countess Elizabeth Bathory in the 17th century Hungary or Ted Bundy in the 1970s. What defines a serial killer is not a single act of violence, but a series of murders committed over time, often with a cooling-off period between them. You might think such violence would lead to a quick arrest, but the unsettling truth is that serial killers often operate for years before patterns emerge. And like his counterparts elsewhere, Louis managed to keep ahead of investigators long enough to leave a lasting mark on Luxembourg's criminal history. Or were investigators simply blinded by the truth and failed to do their job? Something so obvious happening right in front of their own eyes. It's a quiet evening in Luxembourg City on the 9th of March, 1983. Michelle walks alone through a car park near the central station, but she doesn't notice the man following her until it's too late. When she opens the door to her car, Louis suddenly lunges at her from behind. He shoves her into her own vehicle, forcing her behind the wheel and instructs her to drive. She's resisting fiercely, but Louis makes deadly threats. She obeys him. Heart pounding, she steers the car out of the city towards Cockleshire. En route, Michelle offers her attacker money in return for letting her go. But Louis refuses. After 20 minutes, Louis asks Michelle to pull over in a remote area of Cockleshire. Michelle sees an opportunity and tries to make a run for it. Louis latches onto her as she attempts to flee the car, but she can struggle free. She breaks out into a run, but doesn't get far. Louis is catching up. In a frenzy, he stabs her in the back. Covered in blood, Michelle stumbles towards a nearby restaurant, crying for help. She attracts the attention of a staff member, Colette, who shockingly offers Michelle a seat and gestures her to come in. But in that moment, Michelle turns around and collapses on the ground. Colette can see the stab wounds in her back. There is a lot of blood. Michelle dies at the scene. Meanwhile, Louis, the attacker, leaves Cockleshire and goes to work, casually, as if nothing had occurred. By now it's nighttime. He's got a shift at the El Dorado cinema near the Gare. He arrives by 8:30 p.m. Meanwhile in Cockleshire, police are called to the scene and the hunt begins for a murderer. but investigators are left clueless as to where to begin their search. Fast forward to 6 weeks later, the 27th of April 1983, in the southern town of Chifflange. It's a sunny afternoon when the 59-year-old Marguerite leaves her house to go for a walk towards the city centre, along a paved path. Her husband and two children remain at home. But someone's hiding in the bushes. Louis. Out of nowhere, he leaps from the bushes. He first punches Marguerite in the face, then hits her over the head with the butt of a revolver. Her body is discovered 2 hours later, covered in stab wounds. At the time of the discovery, Louis is having a drink at a cafe in neighboring Kyle. He's a phantom, blending into his surroundings, always behaving like nothing happened. Again, investigators have very few leads, but more witnesses are coming together. They initially accuse Marguerite's son, a professional butcher who worked with tools resembling the murder weapon, as the killer. But they were wrong. It was Louis who had committed his second murder, but no one knew. There is a call for witnesses, and earlier that day, somebody had spotted Louis cycling through the street of Marguerite, even ringing the doorbell of her neighbor. Was the neighbor Louis's actual target, and he had confused his victim? Police managed to secure a footprint, bike tracks, and the handbag belonging to Marguerite, which had been looted and is found close to the crime scene. Investigators proceed by drawing up a sketch, or a phantom image, of Louis. And while not a very precise depiction, the image is accompanied by a very precise description. 1.90 meters tall, dark brown hair, 15 to 17 years old, with a round, childlike face. He's a teenager. After two murders within 6 weeks, Louis goes dark. Two years later, on the 22nd of June of 1985, Louis is back, hunting women. And he is back hunting at the same location as 2 years prior. At around 6 p.m. that Saturday, the 22-year-old Rosanna Campanella walks to the fourth floor of the same parking garage where Michelle was abducted in 1983. As she opens the stairwell door, Louis, who is such a large, towering figure, blocks her path. He holds a knife and forces her up another level to the top floor. Rosanna can feel the cold steel against her back. He throws her down, pins her to the concrete steps. Rosanna screams for help. He tells her to shut up or die. And in a moment of terrifying clarity, Rosanna starts talking. Slowly, quietly. Louis seems to calm down. He tells her that he has this impulse to attack her in the way that he is. He tells her she's being taken to Cockleshire, where a car is waiting for her and where she'll be sold to a French brothel. She keeps the conversation going in a calm manner, while on the inside she is desperately screaming for help. He ties her to the top stairwell railing. Louis has packed all kinds of tableware and dishes, and asks Rosanna whether he can leave her alone for a second. She says yes. He tightens the rope around her and disappears downstairs to gather his belongings. With trembling hands and all of her power, Rosanna manages to free herself. She considers taking the lift down, then thinks better of it. What if it stops midway and Louis opens a door? The lift descends all the way to the bottom floor, and she makes a run for it. Rosanna is covered in blood with a cut in the back of her throat, and she is surrounded by lots of people outside in the public, but no one is helping her. Police are alerted and they locate her attacker in no time. Louis is found casually strolling across the bridge, away from the crime scene. He is taken to the police station, where the unexplainable happens. The public prosecutor's office decides not to have enough evidence against him. No one asked Rosanna if she needed help. In fact, her interrogation at the police station takes longer than that of Louis. The killer is free to go. Of course, at this point, the police don't know he's a killer. There is no justice. Louis is back out on the streets, and the attacks continue. In September of 1985, a young woman in Limpertsburg narrowly escapes another assault by Louis. A year later, a woman is attacked in Trier. And in the winter of 1989, yet another attack in Limpertsburg goes unanswered. Then, in November of 1989, the body of a woman is discovered in a kiosk on Avenue de Luxembourg in Kerjeng. She's been bludgeoned to death with an axe in the back of the kiosk's storage room. It's the work of the cold-blooded Louis. Taking place just before closing time, no one witnessed his attack. He drives up to Kochelscheuer to throw his murder weapons into a pond, washes his bloodstains off his hands in the water. Again, Louis is living parallel lives. He makes a phone call to police, however, not to hand himself in, but as a witness to a violent murder that had just occurred in Kerjeng. He was the one committing this violent crime, but as no one saw him do it, he's pretending to be the only witness. Louis goes to the police station and makes up a testimonial. He signs some documents, writes down his story, and leaves. And the case, like so many others before, goes unsolved for months. A dangerous man lying to the authorities, roaming the streets of Luxembourg, murdering and attacking women, and police are not arresting him. Louis the Unstoppable. And amid all the murders Louis is committing, he continues his day job and life in Luxembourg. He is working his job at the Gare Cinema and lives at home with his parents. Then, in a twisted cry for attention, the day after the Kerjeng murder, Louis eventually writes an anonymous letter to the Luxemburger Wort newspaper, claiming responsibility for 4 murders. Only 3 were known. Wort journalists pass the letter on to police, and investigators are stunned. Police run a handwriting comparison check to compare whether Louis' signature and the documents he had written at the police station just the day before were the same. And despite the urgent nature of the letter, the handwriting comparison check takes a staggering 3 months to complete and identify. At this time, all this time, Louis is free to roam the streets. Of course, the handwriting of the letter matches that of Louis at the police station. Finally, based on this evidence, Louis is arrested the next morning. At 6 a.m., police finally raid his family house and put him in handcuffs. When the trial begins in 1992, more information becomes known about Louis Mathias. Louis grew up in a very normal working-class family. His father worked at the steel site in the south. His mother was a catechetin teaching religion. Louis was very socially engaged as a young boy, and he was even an altar boy. There were no signs of Louis stepping onto the wrong path and falling into crime. Even his close friends, of which he just had a few, did not understand how Louis would become who he ultimately became. To those who knew him, Louis was unremarkable, quiet, a bit odd, often alone. He grew up bullied by schoolmates, neighbors, and even his own mother. He liked reading novels and watching movies, which he copied with his friends. He held a job at the cinema, seemed functional, and no one suspected a thing. As one childhood friend told RTL, there was no sign that Louis would do something bad. He did his work, he enjoyed laughing and joking around, but he had a dark side to him. He had a certain way of thinking about women. He spoke poorly of them. He was a misogynist. He had a fascination with weapons. And Louis had committed to some small thefts. Small amounts of money from the church or at school. But it's a long way from stealing to murder. The trial only lasted 4 days. Louis Mathias knew everything in detail, from the first murder until the last. According to observers, he seemed to revel in the trial. The trial was his moment. It was showtime for Louis, one former friend recalled. He described each murder in chilling detail. Louis found strong inspiration in the brutal, violent, and bloody sexual films he had seen and loved. No remorse, no guilt. Only a need to be seen. His victim, Rosanna, had attended the trial. She wanted closure. But what she found was more complicated. She said, "His presence was cold. But I started to feel sorry for him. He was mistreated, unloved. Still, he was a monster." Psychiatrists were brought in, declared that Louis was insane. However, his level of insanity was not sufficient to invoke Article 71 of the Criminal Penal Code, which addresses criminal irresponsibility due to mental state at the time of the offence. In other words, Louis knew very well what he was doing. How did one man attack 7 women over 6 years, killing more than half, and remain entirely undetected? The truth is as shocking as the crimes themselves. There were no leads, no patterns acknowledged, and no support systems in place. Families of the victims were left to grieve alone. Survivors were left without counseling, safety, or even basic reassurance. A systemic failure. One victim was even advised by law enforcement not to file a criminal complaint because, in quotation marks, the attacker knew where she lived. None of Louis's victims were known to him. It was a random selection. Women going about their lives, walking home, parking their cars, taking a shortcut through the park. With his diabolic work, he ripped families and loved ones apart. Regarding Marguerite, the victim of Chifflange, former judge Eliette Baula recalls one particular detail of the crime scene. She said, "He had placed a canola flower on her face. When I asked him why, he said he could not look into her dead eyes." In his time committing crimes, Louis visited a psychologist 4 times. His cry for help was unheard. In the 1980s, psychological support was minimal and often stigmatized. He was sent home, deemed not dangerous. Louis was never reported to the justice system. A further loss of life could have been prevented. Louis's life, then, was marked by isolation, rejection, and bitterness. As one friend put it, "You want to be recognized. You want warmth. A colleague who isn't making fun of you. A girlfriend. Sex. Just a normal life. Like in the movies. We were all in the same boat. Only Louis jumped out." Luxembourg remembers this case not just for its horror, but for what it revealed. A nation unprepared for predatory violence. A justice system slow to act. And victims who were failed again and again. Louis was sentenced to life in prison with forced labor. He never said who his fourth murder was. After 19 years at Trassic Prison, he passed away of cancer in 2011.